Hey folks, today's episode is brought to you by Red Hen Press, the largest and oldest nonprofit independent publishing company in Los Angeles. Red Hen Press publishes poetry, creative nonfiction, memoirs, and fiction, including Unseen City by Amy Sherin, the latest Nervous Breakdown Book Club selection. Red Hen Press has also published best-selling work by Steve Almond, also a guest on this program in the past. Check out episode 513 for his discussion on Bad Stories, an in-depth look at how America came to elect Donald Trump. They've also published work by Fear of Flying author Erica Jong and Erasure author Percival Everett. Red Hen Press focuses on diversity in publishing, offering 10 annual publication awards, and they accept unagented submissions of manuscripts. For more information, visit redhen.org. And best of all, get 40% off your order for a limited time using the offer code OTHERPPL. Over at http://shop.aer.io/red_hen_press.
I am astonished by the sabotage.
Hello, how's it going? I'm Brad Listy. Welcome to the Other People Show. My name's Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. I keep repeating myself. It's been 110 degrees. The state has been on fire. The air is smoky. The sky is kind of orange. The light is weird. COVID-19 is happening. The election is making people crazy. Everything's just crazy. You know, there's just a lot happening. There's a lot of layers. And in the midst of it all, the podcast continues. You can't stop this show. Wildfires won't stop it. Smog won't stop it. Heat won't stop it. I'm in the garage. Is there any ventilation? Is there any air conditioning? No, there's not. My guest today is Matthew Salasis. He's got a new novel out on Little A Publishing, or on Little A Press. It's called Disappear, Doppelganger, Disappear. It has been earning rave reviews. This is Matthew Salas's second appearance on the Other People Show. He first appeared on February 3rd, 2013. I believe that was episode 145. He is the best-selling author of The 100-Year Flood, and he has two books forthcoming in 2021, a craft book called Craft in the Real World, and a collection of essays entitled Own Story. His other previous books include I'm Not Saying, I'm Just Saying, Different Racisms on Stereotypes, the Individual, and Asian American Masculinity, and a book called The Last Repatriate. In 2015, BuzzFeed named Matthew Salas as one of 32 essential Asian American writers. His essays have been published all over the place, and he is currently an assistant professor of English at Coe College in Iowa, where he teaches fiction writing and Asian American literature. Really glad to have Matt back on this program. We had a wonderful conversation. Many of you listening might be familiar with some of the fundraising that I was doing on this show a while back for Matt and his family. Matt's wife, Catherine, was battling stomach cancer, and sadly she passed away, but we were trying to raise money to help them with her treatment, and many of you participated in that. I want to thank you all again, and I just want to acknowledge, you know, that Matt has been through quite a lot, and in the midst of it all, he has been working and publishing and raising his kids. I mean, there's just something heroic in it. And I was just very grateful to him to have the opportunity to connect and catch up and hear how he's doing, you know, despite all of it. And I think, too, when we talked, there was, you know, there had just been this big weather event in Iowa. What was it called? Like the land hurricane? There's so much crazy shit going on. I mean, the last thing this guy needs is a land hurricane. But, you know, there he was. And we talked over the transom. So one quick bit of news, and then we'll get started with the conversation. I think I mentioned in the last episode that I am blogging between now and Inauguration Day 2021. So for the next, you know, what is it, 3-4 months, I'm going to be blogging. I'm going to try to do it on a daily basis. I'm going to try to be maximal in my approach. It essentially amounts to, live blogging or live journaling? Recording in real time my thoughts and feelings on what's happening. it's not going to be, it's not going to be only a political thing. It's going to be diaristic. I don't know what it's going to be, but I just feel like after finishing my novel, I need a new project. I can't imagine thinking or focusing on anything other than the election and the moment that we're in until after it's over with somehow. So I just figure I'll do this, and by doing it publicly and putting myself on the hook, you know, this way, it'll give me, the incentive to do it, or the, you know what I'm saying? You need that internal pressure. So if you want to read, I'm really selling this, am I not? If you want to read my daily thoughts between now and Inauguration Day, you can do that at bradpocalypse.blogspot.com, bradpocalypse.blogspot.com, all right? Okay, so Matthew Salicis is the guest today. His new novel is called Disappear Doppelganger, Disappear. It's available now from Little A Publishing, and just great to have him back on the program. Here he is, folks. This is Matthew Salicis.
It's like hurricane-level winds, but it tears through as fast and like as a tornado or something. It felt like, you know, we got the tornado warning, and the sky looked like tornado weather. And I was like, oh, shit, we're going to have a tornado, you know. The kids were eating their dinner maybe at the time or lunch, and they were like, should we go down to the basement? And I'm like, no, you know, like if we see something near us, we'll go down to the basement. And then suddenly it was just like extreme winds. Things were slamming against our house, or like the playset I have for them like blew into the gulch behind our house. And we ended up having to go down to the basement and just like eating in the dark as the power went out. It was intense.
Wow. Okay. And your kids, I mean, like that's, I remember that from my childhood in the Midwest, how scary tornado warnings and going down to the basement could be. Like that's just a feature of Midwestern existence.
Yeah, I never really, you know, I grew up in Connecticut, so we didn't have tornadoes. I mean, we had hurricanes, but we were pretty far inland, so they only kind of caused minor destruction. But Cedar Rapids suffered like $4 billion worth of damage, and got, I think, like $4 million of assistance from the government just recently-ish. So it's definitely going to take some doing to get the city back on its feet. And I'm supposed to teach classes on Wednesday, and I am barely online. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, my God. So what happened in terms of the level of physical destruction in your neighborhood or at close range to your neighborhood? Like what are we looking at when we go outside? Are we like houses destroyed?
Most of the ones around my street, because we don't have that many trees around. I live in this like suburban construct, right? Even though I'm technically within the city, there's just like, there was a line of really beautiful old trees in this gulch that is there for runoff, I think, right behind my house. That used to separate us from the neighbors in back of us, who are probably, I don't know, 300 feet back there. And now there are like three trees, and the other ones kind of either crashed into yards or sometimes like into fences and part of porches. Luckily, there wasn't much damage over here, but I had a lot of friends who had pretty significant damage. Cars, houses. My friend Liz Lenz has been like the city's savior, as far as I can tell, like really instrumental in getting news coverage and stuff. She had a part of a tree fall through her house. I know she's doesn't have power either, so it's been not great.
yeah,
especially with the pandemic.
Right. It's just like layer upon layer of calamity and just like logistical difficulty. Like it shouldn't be this hard to exist, right?
No, otherwise we would just go to the grocery store at least and like get some, I don't know, non-perishable food. But you're like afraid to go to the grocery store too, especially with your kids, because I'm in Iowa and people are not like wearing masks or really kind of following any of the protocols. And I don't know. It's scary out there.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that. I, like this is, there's going to be an inevitable element of politics, I think, to the conversation. It would happen anyway, but it also figures into your book, and I want to talk to you about that decision. Like, it fascinates me that you went there. You know, not that it's unexpected or entirely unexpected or even inadvisable, but just because I have struggled with that recently in my own writing. Like, how much to engage with it? How much can I tolerate to engage with, like, contemporary politics on the page? You know, it's like sort of this monolith. You can't avoid it in some ways, but it also feels so exhausting to go there, you know, because the the lived experience of it is, like, so fucked that it, you know, you wonder how much, I don't know, I wonder how much I can put myself through, you know. But I want to talk to you first about, you know, the reality on the ground in Iowa. You take this derecho and you kind of overlay all that we were dealing with anyway with all the destruction of the storm. But then you take, like, the political climate of Iowa. And I was speaking with a friend of mine recently. He was at Lake Okoboji, which I think is near you.
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. I think it's up near Cedar Rapids. I could be wrong, but it's a lake in Iowa. He was, like, out there with his wife or partner or something. And, you know, they had a lake vacation, and he was showing me pictures, and it was just like people were just out without masks, just partying on the shores of this lake.
Yeah. Nobody has masks.
Nobody cares. And I guess a question to pose to you in light of what you've said so far is, like, do you think that with the derecho and with the lack of federal response and with COVID, like, is anything moving the needle? Do you feel like there is any kind of malleability to the politics in Iowa or a place like Iowa?
I mean, I'm lucky to be in a city, right? So, you know, the three cities you can probably think of in Iowa, right? Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Iowa City, maybe Quad Cities. The cities are all blue or whatever, Democrat. But it's clearly not reflective of the state as a whole. You've got that kind of same urban-rural split as everywhere else in the country. What does seem kind of strange to me is that I think it's a different thing. I mean, it's politics for sure, but it's also like a kind of Iowan, maybe, I don't know if it applies to the rest of the Midwest, but definitely a kind of Iowan isolationist thinking where I think people think they're just immune here from, like, the problems of the rest of the country, where, like, even liberals in Cedar Rapids who, like, realize the country is going to shit or, you know, has long been going to shit. Sorry, can I say shit?
Yeah.
I know I can, but
yes,
I just wanted to check. Have this idea that, like, okay, it's out there, right? It's like, it's out there and it's happening to other people and I should be aware of this. And, like, I'm against all this stuff that's happening, but I'm, like, immune here in Iowa. And that's why people aren't wearing masks and still having, like, Memorial Day parties and just, it's, you know, and still walking up to your door and ringing your doorbell and trying to talk to you, like, 2 feet away. Like, whoa, this is, like, it's nice to be friendly, but maybe not at the cost of dying. So it's the combination of these two different kinds of politics, I think. One that's just kind of the broader national conversation, and one that's this very specific sense of immunity from the national conversation.
Yeah, my sister lives in Indiana. It's kind of the same thing.
I think,
you know, you have more space in a place like Iowa or Indiana. You know, I live in L.A. Everyone's on top of one another, you know, it seems. And there's just so many people here that it feels a lot more immediate. But it doesn't mean that it's not going to impact these communities. I keep waiting in some kind of, like, dreadful way for the other shoe to drop. I hope it doesn't, but it can be hard to see how it wouldn't if people are going to be this lax about basic safety protocols.
Oh, it is affecting us for sure. I mean, for a little while ago, I was checking the statistics and Iowa had the fastest growing rates, or maybe, like, behind Florida or Texas or something in the country. You know, my parents live in Florida and I worry, my kids and I worry about them all the time, because even though they're wearing masks, you know, they're of a kind of vulnerable age to coronavirus. Nobody else is wearing masks, even though, right, like, they live in this retirement community and everybody's like super vulnerable to coronavirus, and Florida is really terrible right now. Like, the cases are rising, and nobody's following the rules anyway. It just is so different from, like, you know, we have family in Korea, or my wife's family, my late wife's family is all in Korea, and they just, it's so different there, right? Everybody was wearing masks everywhere. You know, they just completely shut down the country basically for like a month. And afterwards, a few months later, like, there were basically no cases of coronavirus and they can just kind of live their normal life. There's just this like huge concert in Seoul where like a ton of people were out on the streets. It's really amazing to me to think, like, some of it must be this kind of like weird American individualism, I think, right? Like, where we think we're not thinking of the whole and we're kind of acting in our own self-interest. Whereas like in Korea, they're so nationalistic. We are too, but like so nationalistic in a way that is like more of a, the nation is one rather than like the nation is the freedom of the individual, that everybody is kind of aware that their own actions impact other people. Sometimes that makes it like very competitive and stuff. But here it was really amazing to see just that people, you know, in their daily actions are really thinking about how they will affect others and how others will affect them.
Mm. Well, this kind of ties into your book, at least a little, you know, loosely.
Totally.
This idea of self and other and identity and how we conceive of such things. The argument that I've been having lately with friends of mine, I think of one friend in particular who is like among my more conservative friends, and I like to, like, we have this kind of like in a way it's kind of lovely, just this argumentative text thread that spans like two decades almost.
Wow.
I need it, you know, like I need to have that dialogue. It makes me feel sane in some way to not be bubbled, you know, and to at least be able to communicate with somebody who might see things differently. And the argument that I keep trying to make is that, you know, this federalist approach to COVID, where it's like, well, let the states handle it, let the localities decide based on their needs, has been a disaster. Like, you know, what I would say is that you need, or we needed, a unified, strong response from the very top. We needed a president. You know, we needed an actual president who could coordinate with governors and say, hey, you know, we all got to lock arms on this. Like, this is how we do it. And this isn't just me just like blustering. Like, look around the world, just like you were saying, like, how many people have died in South Korea? We reported our first case of COVID as nations, I believe, on the exact same day. Mm-hmm. And I want to say there are under 1,000 COVID deaths in South Korea. It could be significantly smaller than even that. But like the last time I checked the numbers, it was just this dramatic disparity. And it just hammers home the point that Trump is a colossal failure in so many ways, and that all of this death and economic destruction has in many ways been needless. It's infuriating.
Yeah, so much of it is like the world that we live in, right? And the like the different worlds that we live in. One being this, like, you know, the world, the local world that we live in our kind of personal world, but then also this, like, the world as affected by the government forces and institutional forces that, like, control how we live and what amenities we have, which are often really amazing, and but also, like, the response to diseases or the response to, like, a kind of unified response across a nation is all just out of our hands.
So I want to ask you like a fairly delicate question around race, considering especially that you live in Iowa, which is a predominantly white state, you know, in this time of COVID. And we have a president who is, you know, openly racist in so many ways, but has been so with respect to COVID by calling it the Chinese virus and all this stuff. You know, I'm just curious to know, like, have you had any experience of repercussions from that sort of rhetoric? Have you felt it as an Asian man living in a place like Iowa during this time?
I have not, but I know definitely it has been felt quite strongly. My neighborhood is fairly Asian, especially for like Iowa. It's super Asian, even though it's probably like, I don't know, 15 to 20%. But one of the things about quarantining is just the ability to kind of, well, before this happened, before all the power outages happened, to be within your house and not have to interact with other people at all. You know, I felt more of that actually before, you know, just on a personal level. I think on a national level, obviously, it's different. But my daughter would come home from school every day, right, complaining about different things. And I would have to kind of explain the larger things at work that, right, kind of have contributed to small interactions that she has with teachers and friends. And now I don't have to do that just because we're at home all the time. And the only influences she has around her are like me, her brother, and, you know, YouTube or whatever. Right. So I've actually been, I've kind of enjoyed, and it's terrible to say this because I can like, of what's happening on a grand scale and to other people. But being at home with my kids has been really amazing in many ways. Just the difference between when you're like that larger world that you have to live in, right? Like you can't like not send your kids to school. Well, I mean, you could, I guess you could homeschool them or something, or like subject them to various interactions with your neighbors, or take them to the, you know, children's museum or something, or go into public at all and have to interact with people all the time. And now it's like socially acceptable to just, well, somewhat socially acceptable to just stay in your home all the time. And my kids have just are so much more confident, right? Like it's really kind of sad. I mean, it is really sad to think that when they're home, they kind of blossom in all these amazing ways. And that going out into the world is really to say like, this world is not for you, in a way that they don't have to feel like when they're in their house. So it's been, you know, a mixed bag, I think, following like the national conversation and then what's happening just in like my 3-person household.
Yeah. You know, I think that if there's any silver lining to COVID, it is that it has forced a lot of people, I think, into a space where they are entertaining some radical new ideas about a lot of different things like education, parenthood, where to live, how to live. You know, I can't help but imagine that there's going to be some positives that come out of this because of the kind of crucible that we're in, not just with COVID, but with all of it, you know. And I think one of the things I've noticed as a parent is how my kids seem less tired. I think that the day-to-day, going to school and waking up and going to this appointment and going to that appointment and constantly being on the move, sometimes in the rush of life, you can lose sight of how tiring that is for children. Mm-hmm. I think of my son in particular, who, you know, has some disabilities and has to go to all these different therapy appointments. And, you know, one of the hard parts of COVID has been that he can't do that anymore. So we're worried that he's losing some opportunities to make gains, you know, while his body and mind are still young. He can't go to therapy, but he does it, you know, over the computer. But the flip side is that, you know, he was going to school, leaving school, driving across town, going to one appointment, driving across town, napping in the car, going to another appointment. And, you know, the guy's 4 years old, you know, like it's a lot for a kid to have to do. And in the absence of that, I've noticed that there's maybe a little bit less crankiness or fatigue. And there is something nice about having your kiddos around all the time.
Yeah. You realize too, like how little time, I mean, I realized this before, but it really sinks in how little time you get to spend with your kids in like a normal, American lifestyle where they're like just at school all the time, and then you take them to other classes or after school activities, and you're working, and you know, you have dinner, and then basically they have to go to bed, right? And you barely get to interact with them as people. It's so functional, right? So much of it is so functional. But now it's both like sometimes kind of maddening, but also it's really amazing to see just what they can do when they are just given all the freedom of time. You know, my kids, I think, have grown a lot closer to each other too, just because they only have each other to play with. And I kept telling them before, like, you guys are what, like 75% genetically the same. And like, there's nobody else like you, like nobody else so much like you in the world. And so you should be the closest, right? This is your team. Like, you guys are the team. And I don't know if that really sank in until now, right? Until all of this happened.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, that's nice to see, you know, when your kids sort of, and I think too, our kids are at a good age. I think our kids are roughly the same age. Mine are 10 and 5.
Yeah, 9 or 9 and 3.
Yeah, so, you know, I think this age in COVID, it's not to say that it's easy, but I think it's easier than if they were like, you know, 15 and 13 or something. I think when you get into those years and your friends are kind of like maximally important, to suddenly be in quarantine is difficult. Teenagers, I think, are having a harder time. College students, you know, it's got to be, imagine being like a sophomore in college and going through this, you know, like.
Yeah, I can't imagine how they're even like, you know, my university and other universities are trying to enforce these rules on college students that are basically like, don't live in college, right? Like, this, the whole experience is designed to like get them away from their family for the first time and give them all of this freedom. And then, you know, in order to keep them safe on campus, because they have to be on campus because the companies, the universities/companies, need to make money from it. It's just really hard for them, I'm sure, to not want to. I mean, I'm sure they're still doing it, right? Like, they're still going to parties and still trying to do the things that make them feel like they have a new kind of life, right? It's, I don't know. I doubt all of this, all of the university stuff is going to work out that great. But I'm a pessimist, so I have no idea.
You and me both. I mean, yeah. There are certain activities that I, you know, I see online. I'll be reading a news story or, you know, scrolling through Twitter, and you'll see some sort of video and, you know, like a college party where you just have everybody standing around a keg without masks on, or you'll see some sort of college party where everyone's standing around with masks on. In both cases,
right,
it seems sort of dreadful to me. Yeah. And then, you know,
they're still going to hook up, right? Go back to their, you know, dorms, meet strangers. Like, there's still 18 to 22 year olds, most of them, and full of hormones and like freedom. Right. It's just a disaster.
It is. And then, like, I got an email from some yoga studio in LA, you know, like, I'm on some list, you know what I'm saying? So you get these like promotional, you know, marketing emails.
Just
I get, it's, you know, God knows how many of those I get a day, but there's this yoga studio in LA, and they're like advertising now rooftop yoga, like outside, and you know, bless them, because they're trying to make it work, you know, they're trying to just keep their business alive. But they have photos of people on top of a parking garage in full sun exposure, just baking in like desert sun with a mask on doing yoga. And I'm like, just forget it. Like, really? Like, is anybody going to do this? Like, this is so dystopian and nightmarish. I cannot imagine like doing yoga like in the heat like that without a mask on. But to have a mask on trying to breathe, it just, you know, seems ridiculous.
Hot yoga,
yeah.
times 10.
Yeah, right. I mean,
I think what's really interesting when you say dystopian too is like, we keep I feel like literary dystopias are imagining like, you know, everything is broken down and a new way of life has sprung up, right? A new way of life that like also symbolically represents our way of life. But like, the actual dystopia is everything's broken down and people are still clinging to the old way of life, right? And still trying to live it out as if like nothing has changed. even though we're living in dystopia. We're living in dystopia. For a while, I was just starting every sentence, like of every essay, living in a dystopia, we are, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the massive shifts to our reality that have happened over the past, you know, 4 years, there's still a lag time in terms of people, I think, including me, like fully wrapping our heads around what the implications are and also what has actually happened in its totality. There's so much to keep track of that even for somebody who's paying attention and who's reasonably rational and well-informed, it can be hard to sort of parse it all. And I think it's going to be a long process. I also think that some of the changes that we've needed to make around, you know, like a range of issues, I think of climate as maybe one of the more pressing ones that are long overdue. You know, I think hopefully we're getting to a place where soon people are just going to come together, or at least enough people are going to come together and reckon with it.
Yeah, I guess you're still an optimist, though, Brad.
I mean, listen,
I'm looking at this being like, how long until we're Snowpiercer? Right? Like, how long until I have to like fight my way up from the back of the train, eating the ground up cockroaches?
I mean,
you remember all those articles that came out like a few years ago about how there are viruses living in the ice, right, or preserved in the ice, and how as global warming happens, the all these other older pandemics are going to come out of the ground and eat us. I think about that constantly now, and like how underprepared we are for a pandemic we knew was happening, and that like didn't come out of the ground and wasn't like millions of years old, and what's going to happen to us if that actually comes true. It's horrifying.
There are any number of eventualities that are not that far-fetched, you know, that if you sit around for even like 20 minutes contemplating them can just leave you in a state of either paralysis or just like mortal doom, you know. So I want to talk to you about the composition of your book. I feel like I want to commend you for being so productive and getting so much good work done in the midst of all that you've been through over the past few years. As I understand it, Disappear Doppelganger Disappear was written while your late wife was sick with cancer. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, so I started it. It's kind of followed my sad life story. I started after my daughter was born, which was an amazingly happy event, but also was like a lot of weird adoption trauma for me. And I put it aside for a while, and then I did a lot of the major.
Can I interrupt? But you just said there's a lot of weird adoption trauma. Can you just explain a little bit more what that means?
Sure. Well, before my first child was born, I had this idea, just because of being adopted, that kids were like blank slates. You know, that's how my parents had kind of always approached it, as if like, you know, we raised you. My parents used to say like, you bite your nails because your dad bites your nails, which I totally believed until recently, when I realized that like we do these things genetically. You know, my daughter was born and she had a personality. Right. She recognized our voices. She had desires of her own. She had like, one of the things I think is really interesting about having a personality is part of a personality is like how far you'll go to get what you want. Like, at what point do you kind of give up or like change your approach? My daughter, even from, you know, immediate birth and infancy, would never give up on anything she wanted. Would just kind of push it until she either got it or she had like completely exhausted herself. For a while, until she was three, she wouldn't sleep at night until like 4 a.m. Just like pure will. And so all of those things really shook up the way I thought of who I was, right? Like where I came from, where like my personality came from. And it was very hard to deal with. Just, I mean, it was a huge identity shift. And it was very difficult for me to think like that my screwed up way of thinking about who a person is and who I was would not also like screw up my kid in ways that I wouldn't, in the ways that she wouldn't know either until like maybe she had kids or, you know, many years later. You know, I was thinking at the time, right, like, I'm going to therapy now, right? That was like maybe the first time I really did serious therapy. And I'm realizing all the shit that screwed me up when I was a kid, that I just kind of either tried to forget, ignore, or like told stories around. And I just didn't realize how much it had affected me until I was, 29, on the therapist's couch or whatever.
Can you tell me not to go deeply into it, but just like as an example of something as a kid that might have affected you, but you didn't realize the extent to which it did.
I mean, the stuff about, you know, my parents did their best, but they didn't even know. I mean, one of the things that really hit me when we had our first kid was like, my mom didn't know anything about how to raise a baby. You know, like, well, I was adopted when I was 2. My siblings are both adopted, but, you know, they were adopted when they were like 6 or 9 months. And she kept like suggesting things that you couldn't do with an infant. You know, like immediately when the baby was born, she was like, put them on timers, lock them in the other room and let them, sleep for 6 hours. I was like, this is just not a thing that you can do right now, right? Like the child has to feed every like 2 hours because it's like used to this kind of womb life. And she didn't know like how to comfort a baby. And then my mother-in-law was there because she'd come from Korea to help take care of the child. And if we had problems, she would just pick up the child and like immediately calm it down in a way that was both amazing, but also terrifying to me. Like just to know like all of the things that I didn't know and my parents didn't know that had gone into like raising me, you know. And so I just didn't realize how much of an impact they had on my life until later. Things like, which I found out later, that I had when I was a kid, I like hated to mow the lawn, hated to wear turtlenecks, like really constricting socks. I felt like I was dying, really, almost literally. And my parents would have these huge blowout fights with me, and I was just, I can't do this, right? Like, I can't do this. And I would end up running away. I ran away from home a lot as a kid, also because I was, like, terrified of my father. And when my daughter was born, she had the same kind of sensitivities. Like, she wouldn't, when she was like 3 years old, 6 years, I mean, 3 months old, 6 months old, we took her like outside and she wouldn't like put her feet on the grass or like get in the dirt at all. She didn't like the texture, right? And so we started having to figure out what was going on with her, and we found that she had processing disorder. And as she was going through the therapies for this, right, like 1 year old or something, we had people coming over to the house to help her kind of deal with sensory overload and stuff. I was going through the same training with her, right, because you need a parent to kind of show them that it's okay and to get into it. But I was having like a terrible, terrible problem with all of the things that she had to do. Like one time we had to put our hands in like jelly or something, jam. And it was so horrifying to me. And I realized, oh, like this is what I've had all my life. And my parents just like didn't deal with it at all. Like didn't think of it at all as something that they could help me with or that, you know, could explain some of my behavior. And now I'm realizing with my own child, because she's genetically, right, related to me, that the things that she has going on are things that I had going on. And so it was really kind of changing the way I thought of my childhood. And, you know, in the book, in the novel, The Spirit Doppelganger Disappear, the question at the beginning of the book is like, what is wrong with him? which was a question I really wanted to explore from the beginning of writing the novel. I just think it's an interesting question when somebody else says to you, what is wrong with you? What is it that you are doing that isn't like registering with the rest of the world? And for me, it was like this big moment, or like an unfolding series of moments, in which I tried to understand. My daughter is now burst into the room and said, "Just leave it. Just leave it. There's someone at the door. Just don't answer." Man, I don't even know what I was talking about now. Oh, I was trying to figure out like what was wrong with me, and what I thought was wrong with me was just totally different from what was like unfolding and telling me that maybe possibly that what was wrong with me was not so much like my own individual failings, and instead like circumstantial, environmental things, and genetic things that if I had had like a biological parent who recognized these things in themselves, might have handled all of this very differently. And so I was going through a lot of that while I was thinking about like how, because I didn't know anything about parenting, and because I didn't know anything about how my biological parents would have parented me, and my parents hadn't parented me until I was 2 and a half. And so they didn't really have any memory of what I was like as a child that could be applied to like what my daughter was like before she was 2 and a half. I had this like incredible fear of just kind of destroying her life, either just through a kind of repeated trauma or just because I didn't know that I was doing it. And so I had a really hard time with that. And I started the book thinking, I'll just kind of try to deal with some of this stuff on the page. At the time there was this thing that people, I guess, still say, like, you have to write about your worst fears. And so I thought I'll do that, right? I'll make this guy who's, you know, maybe like me in the future, who's like driven away his kid and his wife and his adopted parents and is like all alone. And then has also like done this to himself in a way, right? Like has like really done this to himself. And the way I thought to think of, you know, the way I thought to kind of write about that was I started the book with the title, The Murder of the Doppelganger. And it was originally a kind of murder mystery in which the narrator discovered that his doppelganger had been murdered and would find out like eventually basically that in some symbolic way he had murdered the doppelganger himself, right? Like he'd killed himself off. He was killing himself off, and that was kind of his life and what was going wrong with his life. And that's where the kind of germ of the novel came through. And by the time I was kind of doing the major revisions that you do, right, like with your editor, because I pushed back the book, I don't know, 3 years maybe, just because of all the shit that was happening in my life. My wife was dying of cancer and getting chemo treatments, and I was accompanying her on these train rides back and forth from Busan to Seoul, Korea, and then spending, you know, 3 days to a week in the cancer hospital with her, surrounded by all of these other cancer patients, all women, all suffering from stomach cancer like her. And in this like amazing building, all devoted to cancer in Gangnam, which is like a super rich district of Seoul. You probably know from the Gangnam Style song. And looking out the window, you could see like Lotte Tower, which is this like monument to capitalism, right? One of the largest brands in Korea and a kind of global monopoly, really. Like in Korea, there are these kind of like monolith brands that like Samsung that actually make like every single product you can possibly think of. And though, even though we only get like certain products, they're actually making everything. And so you can get like a Samsung TV, but you can also get like a Samsung like toothbrush and like a Samsung vacuum cleaner and like everything. And so Lotte is one of these brands, and you can look out the window at this like huge tower that's built to this monument of capitalism and this other way of life, where people are like striving to get thing more and more possessions and like live a certain way that we used to think was like a happy life until cancer hit. And in the ward itself, it was just a totally different life going on, right? The only thing that mattered was living, and everyone was so actively just trying not to die. It was just a complete mind trip. And I was working on the book at that time, and the same kinds of questions were present. I mean, the book was still asking a similar kind of what is wrong with Matt Kim, which is also like, what is wrong with society, right? What is wrong with the world that tells Matt Kim that he should be a certain way? What is wrong with Matt Kim who tells himself that he should be a certain way in order to fit into the world? And just coming up with like, coming up against a very different situation where what mattered was very different. And I spent a lot of time by my wife's side while she was sleeping in a lot of pain, trying to like sleep off the pain from chemo, working on the book, thinking about these questions of like, what are we living for? And, you know, why aren't some people trying so hard to live? And why are we trying so hard to live a certain kind of life? And, you know, just all of these very existential questions and questions about like what happens when you die. Like, you know, if the body and the mind are the same thing, which I really believe they are, what the hell happens when your body dies, right? You know, like just these things that were kind of shaking up all of these different thoughts about religion and existence and love and living and dying. And I did a lot of the work on the novel then, trying to figure out what it all meant to this person who thought he was disappearing from his life, right? That's a very long way of saying what I really want to say is thank you so much to the many people who helped raise money for my wife's chemo treatments. And Brad, you were so instrumental in that. And Roxanne, for matching those donations. I still have those t-shirts and I wear them all the time from the fundraiser you did. And my wife, you know, really wanted to express her gratitude as well. And I probably just kind of screwed that up because I couldn't think about anything else at the time, but thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And we should say Roxanne Gay, you know, she was a big part of that fundraiser.
Roxanne,
very, very generous human being.
Really amazing. But so many people were kind of there for me during that time. And it, you know, we had no health insurance because my wife had moved to America. And we were on Obamacare, but Obamacare turned out to be like not that great for us, at least, and or just like not to have that much coverage, especially for somebody who couldn't afford to like get the premium level of Obamacare. And we ended up having to pay for all of this cancer treatment out of pocket, whereas if she had just stayed in Korea, one, they would have like just found the cancer much earlier. Stomach cancer is very common in Korea, and they test for stomach cancer, right? Like when you go in for your physical, they'll test you the way we test for like breast cancer. And there are certain points where people there will do like full body scans just to test for like all these different cancers. And the way that we don't do it here, because it costs too much money, right? There it's covered by the government. So she would have just caught it much earlier, and then everything would have been covered by government insurance if she had lived there, and by her insurance that she had had on top of that in Korea, which she was paying like, I don't know, like $3 a month or something for, that we just didn't have anymore because we had come here. And so we really did rely totally on donations to try to save her life. And she lived, you know, a year at least longer than anybody expected her to live, which we were really grateful for. But in the end, it was just It was just too much. It had already metastasized by the time we caught it.
It's just infuriating to hear that, you know, that anybody going through that in the richest country in the history of the world should have to raise funds to pay for treatment. Like, that is outrageous.
It seems like everybody's doing, right, like GoFundMe to pay for hospitals and to pay for, like, damage from the storms or to pay for, like, we now rely on these, like, fundraising websites to help us survive in a country that is so rich, right? Like, could help us to survive. I saw this horrifying graph the other day, which of course I knew, like, but to see like a time lapse of how taxes have changed from 1950, when like the rich were paying like 90% taxes or something and the poor were paying like 5% taxes, to how like the line basically leveled out and now actually is like the uber rich are paying less percentage wise in taxes than the super poor. It's just horrifying. It's nothing you can do but laugh.
Well, and there's a layer of kind of sickening irony to what you just talked about, in the sense that people who, you know, tend to be on the political right in the modern political context, who advocate for lower taxes on corporations and the rich, sort of as a rule, often idealize the 1950s as the sort of halcyon era of conservative life in America. They always, like, that was when America was great. You know, that's the America they think they want to go back to. And they often have no idea that the top marginal tax rate in America during the 1950s was 90%. And that people like Jeff Bezos were paying 90%. I don't even know what capital gains taxes were back then. I don't know what the rate was on passive income, but, you know, like, there's a big lesson in that. And, there's like a lesson in basic math and, like the humanity of sane tax policy. But there's also a lesson in human ignorance and a complete blindness to history, the basic facts of history, you know, and the way these things can get warped in people's minds, is telling. So, like, don't even get me started on that, but hopefully things will take a turn. I know we just had our pessimism optimism conversation a bit ago, but like, I'm clinging to hope that like things will begin to right themselves in January, and, you know, hopefully we can get enough people on board to push things in a saner direction and to recalibrate our governmental and societal understanding of the balance between individual liberty and collective responsibility. And, you know, your novel speaks to this in some way. And I think it's a conversation that we so desperately need to have. It doesn't surprise me that it's on your mind. And I'm not suggesting that it's just politics that's driving your, fascination with it. I think there's a lot more to it than that. But I think that our country and maybe the world, but especially our country, a place that seems to be so just deeply identified with this idea of individual liberty, needs to have a real conversation about the relationship between these two things, and to recalibrate our understanding of the relationship between the individual and the collective, because you can't have one without the other, right? You can't have, you know, I don't think it's possible to have a healthy functioning society in which the collective is supreme to the exclusion of all concerns around individual liberty, or vice versa. There has to be an interrelationship between the two, but I just think we're out of balance.
Yeah, I feel like we're living like under a very powerful story of desire. There's this essay I thought of all the time as Trump was running, and I was like convinced that he would easily win, by Joan Kopchak, about Ronald Reagan and the lies that he was telling the public. And there was this, at the time, there was this one news station that was devoted an entire segment to just like tell it, like fact checking all of the things that Reagan was saying and showing how everything was a lie. And it made no difference, right? Like people would watch this and it made no difference at all to like their support of Reagan. And Kupchik makes this like amazing argument that the reason why it doesn't work is because people like they don't desire a story that tells them like all these individual facts. What they desire actually is Reagan, right? They have this like desire attached to the idealism of being this like beautiful actor / politician who's successful in life and has this like amazing American lifestyle, right? And the same thing seems to be happening with Trump. It's like people don't care what the truth is because that's not like what the actual story for them is. The story is like one day we could become like this, right? And if he lies and if he like, you know, is actually broke, who cares? He's like the fucking president of the United States, right? And if I can become like him, it's this kind of weird desire for Trump himself, which like pushes away all of the various things that we think would like break through that story, because those things like don't stop somebody's desire to be like a rich white person in the presidency without having actually done anything to deserve it. You know, like that's like the ideal thing for a lot of people. And the more that we kind of fight against that with things that actually make it seem like even more appealing in a weird way, it doesn't really seem to be working that well. But we've been kind of under the same story, I think, for a long time. You know, I mean, we live under the thumb of this like really powerful story.
And I think too, you know, what is it? Two of the four Republican presidents of the past 40 years have been film or television stars. That's not an accident. You know, I'm thinking of, I'm forgetting the guy's name. He wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death. Do you know this book?
No.
But he's a, you know, if, I want to say he's from Columbia University or some New York university, but he's a social critic, you know, and thinker who wrote in the 1980s, like what turned out to be a very prophetic book about American culture and how when you have like an image based, I'm probably going to fuck this up, like epistemology, is that the word?
Mm-hmm.
Versus a word based epistemology, which is the way things were prior to television. You know, it has a way of dumbing things down, and you turn like, you know, the news and American political discourse into entertainment, and it has catastrophic effects, you know? And so you fit into that dynamic, you know, Ronald Reagan, this sort of empty vessel, conservative former film star who like, you know, was doing movies with chimpanzees. And then like 25 years later, he's the president, you know, like, and then you have Donald Trump, who's like a bad reality TV star, but also, you know, I think if there's any gift Trump has that is clearly defined and irrefutable, it's his gift for understanding the medium of television in its, you know, in its crudest dynamics. You know, how to arrest attention, how to control a media narrative, how to redirect people, how to relate to a camera, like that sort of stuff is very natural to him. You know, he's been doing it his whole life. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, he was able to move through the system. But, you know, along the same lines, I've been having this conversation somewhat frequently lately, you know, because we're in a political season. But, you know, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama on the Democratic side, natural, telegenic, you know, megawatt, superstar kind of qualities, you know, they play well on TV, and it's a necessity. I think it might not be something you like or even agree with, but it's hard to refute this idea that you have to be good on TV in order to succeed in politics. And so, you know, I've been thinking about the Democratic ticket, and I was telling my friend, I'm like, look, Biden, you know, he wasn't my choice, but at least he sort of like adheres to some idea of like the central casting idea of what an American presidential politician looks and sounds like. Like his voice has a certain, you know, baritone or whatever quality to it. He's got the big like piano key smile, you know, like kind of like a, you know, something like out of the past. And then when he picked Kamala, I was like, she looks great on TV. And everyone can say, well, that's really reductive. And, you know, I totally get that argument, but I also think it matters. And I hate to, I hate to say it in some ways, but she's got that like megawatt smile and just like all that kind of like telegenic charisma. And so part of me is like, okay, they have a fighting chance, you know, because I think in the absence of that, in our culture anyway, it's difficult to be successful.
Yeah, there's an interesting, there's a lot of interesting things in there.
I mean, do you agree? Am I off the track? I mean, it sounds like you're thinking about it.
No, I'm thinking about it because I'm thinking about when Trump was, you know, running for the nomination, what I was noticing was, right, like all of the coverage was about either how he could never win or about, you know, the danger of him winning or like how, you know, whatever. Everything, all the coverage was about Trump, right? Like, and even when Hillary was running against her, it was all coverage like, don't, you know, like we have to beat Trump, and still kind of the same thing now. And I worry about that. I think Obama won because he centered the conversation on himself. It was like, can this person become president? Can we have the first African American president? Or how he can't become president, right? Like everything was about him, both positive and negative. And when Trump was running, everything was about him, was positive and negative. And it's, a lot of it is just like tension and like branding, right? Like the more you see something, the more it's just there, right? Like the more awareness of it you have, and the more it kind of filters into the story of America. And so I do worry, I mean, in that aspect, I actually think like, what I was thinking of originally was, you know, going back to the pessimist argument and saying like a pessimist might say, when the pandemic broke out, Trump thought, well, this is a pretty good opportunity, right? To keep like certain people at home who would be most, you know, most likely to stay at home during this, and maybe like least likely to vote for me. And then, you know, like suddenly we've got the post office isn't being defined. And then like, there's just like, if you kind of think about it from a evil genius level, all of these things like really make sense in like a weird way that probably, you know, you probably couldn't explain Trump as an evil genius, but it's just like, so it's depressing. It's so depressing.
Do you have any sense of how things are going to go? I'm going to get off politics, but it's so in the air right now. It's kind of unavoidable. Like, do you have?
I don't think Biden is going to win. I don't think it's going to happen. I think if we had, you know, like a voting system that made sense, that he would easily win. Right? Like, there's just no question that the facts say the majority of Americans are anti-Trump and pro-Democrat, right? The problem is, like, that's just not how our system works, you know? I'm floored all the time by, like, countries that have set up, like, online voting, you know? Like, the day is taken off. It's, like, a holiday, voting holiday, and then people can just, like, vote from their phones, and it's totally secure. And it's just, like, and all the votes are counted automatically. It's just amazing that we can't, that we could easily do this, actually, but we just refuse to do it. It's actually, like, completely 100% makes sense that we don't do it, but only if you kind of think in the evil genius kind of way, right? Like, everything makes sense if you just think of the worst-case scenario.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like, if you can't win on the merits, you know, if the policies that you advocate for simply aren't popular enough to carry the day, then I guess your alternative is to try to suppress the vote and cheat. And that's how you can keep power or get power. Like, that's the only rationale you could possibly have for not wanting a fair fight, right? Like, why would you, I don't know. It's very maddening.
I don't think, like, I think a lot of people, I don't think Trump was in the presidency for a fair fight. You know, like, that's what, you know, I don't think that was, like, any part of the premise for certain people running for government offices. There are definitely some people who, like, would want a fair fight, but I think, actually, I maybe am too cynical, but I think a lot of people running for those offices are in no way in it for the fair fight, right? Like, they're in it to, like, the purpose is to exploit the system. That's why they're running for an office, a position of in government, is to exploit the system. So of course they're going to try to exploit it in you know, gaining votes.
So the mood in Iowa, you think Iowa is pretty Trumpy? Yeah, I guess you're probably seeing lots of that. Do you see like MAGA hats and stuff like that around?
I do not, because I live in the city, thankfully.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But, you know, I think Iowa would probably, yes, go for Trump. Mm-hmm. It's just another thing. Like, I think people are against the policies. Even, like, a lot of people who will vote for him are still against the policies. But, again, they're like, that, you know, politics is local politics, right? Like, there's no way in which those policies for a lot of those voters are actually affecting them on a personal individual level, and that's how they're voting.
So I want to ask you about the conception of your book, just in terms of, like, nuts and bolts, because, you know, there's a lot going on. It's a bit of like a high concept idea, if we can use that phrase. I guess I'm wondering, like, how you did it. Like, was this something that you outlined? Was this something that you intuited? Did you just come up with, like, a basic conceit and then just sort of start feeling your way through the story from there? Like, how do you work to flesh this thing out and make it real on the page and make it make sense?
Oh, Brad, I'm going to tell you, this. I wrote the first draft using the George Costanza method. Which is, like, do whatever you think the opposite of whatever you think you would normally do. At the time, the 100-Year Flood wasn't selling to editors, and you know, the baby had been born, and I was just depressed, and I thought, I'll just you know, like, I'm clearly doing it wrong, and so maybe I'll just do the opposite, right? Like, the opposite of what I would think to do. And so I did that for a whole draft. I wrote, like, you know, 1,000 words a day or something every day for months and months. And at the end of it, I had a draft in which things appeared and disappeared randomly and out of the blue, which was apparently how my imagination works. I don't know. I must have thought, like, the least expected thing for me was just that something would go away and then come back again. And so what I had after that was just, like, this messy thing that had a kind of, like, propulsion to it, but the propulsion was based on, like, this very manufactured George Costanza method. And so I had to kind of do a lot of work to just try to figure out, like, why... what is wrong with me? Like, why would I do that? Why would that be the thing I would think of? Disappearance and reappearance, and through kind of trying to figure out, like, what in my consciousness would be kind of would be attracted to this idea. I was trying to figure out too, like, what the book was about and what I was even trying to do with fiction at all. So it took me 7 years to write the book. And I'd say, like, maybe a 3-year chunk of that at least was just me, like, struggling really, really painfully, and writing, like, the same things over and over again in different ways. And just every time it didn't seem right, and just trying to figure out, like, what the thing was, what it was at all, and, like, what I was doing at all. And so much of the process for me was not on paper. I mean, not planned in any way. It was more just interrogating myself. And once I was able to like give up on the idea of what I was wanted to do and to rethink that through. I mean, I think, see, I'll tell you, like, I sold the book when the 100-year flood was doing really well. And in that month period where a book does seem to have some success, I was like, oh, this is the time, right? So I sold the book on spec then, and I thought it would be really amazing to be able to write a book after it was already sold. I thought, like, this will be so much more relaxing. Like, it'll take all the stress out of, like, will this book be sold out of the equation? And it totally backfired. It completely backfired for years, where it was just like so paralyzing to me just to try to figure out then, like, what the hell, why am I doing this book at all? Right. Like, what I was doing with 100 Year Flood was clearly, I realized after the next book had sold, was trying to sell the book. I'd been writing a book to try to sell a book. And when that was off the table, I had to have like a real purpose for writing the book. And I didn't have one, you know, I just didn't have one. And it took me a really long time just to figure that out. And I wrote, I think a lot of the craft essays and stuff that I have written have just kind of came out of me trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I like wasn't doing it for these like weird commercial reasons and like was doing it in terms of like what I wanted to get across through the form of an imaginary thing to a real person on the other side. And I just spent a long time trying to figure that out and maybe never did, but hopefully it makes some sense.
Yeah. You know, that speaks to me. Maybe not in a one-for-one way, but I just finished the process of writing a very personal book. It's a novel, but it's like, you know, really sort of emptied myself out is the kind of after effect. I imagine you can relate to that, where you feel like you just sort of poured all of yourself into a project and then the question comes.
Do you feel like you'll never write again now?
Yeah.
That usually leaves me the feeling like, I guess I'm done.
Yeah. Well, and I think I've been having conversations here and there with like writer pals of mine lately. And I'll have it here with you just because you've written about craft so much and you teach and you obviously think a lot about these things explicitly. But where I struggle is that, you know, something you said earlier about writing about what you're, what is it, most afraid of, like your worst fears. Writing about the thing you're trying to avoid, writing about the thing that's most difficult for you or the thing you would maybe want to hide or something tends to be a good strategy because there's real blood on the page and there's emotion in it and that's good for the reader. You know, it might not be great for you in the writing process, but I think it yields something on the page that can move people, which is why, you know, or it's a lot of the reason why we go to books. And so one of the challenges I think on future projects for me is like, do I sit around waiting for more bad shit to happen so that I'll have material, you know?
Well, maybe.
Yeah, or maybe I can make it happen. Or, you know, do I move off in a more imaginative direction, like purely imaginative direction? And if so, how do I get myself to care, like to feel the same sense of like personal heart level investment in the project? Like, do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, that's the first thing I teach when I teach creative writing. We spend the first week always on vulnerability in the lower workshops, just in like an introductory fiction workshop. I agree completely. I mean, I think I used to be, you know, my students used to ask this question. I don't know why they don't ask it anymore. Maybe they just don't trust me. But they used to ask me, like, how can I, like, what's the fastest way to be a better writer? I was like, I fucking know. You know, like, write for 10,000 hours. No, but then I started to think, like, maybe it's just, maybe it's something you do on yourself, right? Like, it's about vulnerability and being able to, like, to access those places and to kind of be okay with writing about those things and even to be like to want to explore those things, which may not be like necessarily a natural state of living in this kind of world, which sometimes I think is more about like avoiding those things, right? And so we spend the first week talking about what it means to kind of invest yourself on the page, even if that doesn't mean like writing about your worst fear. Like, you know, what I tell them is like, if you've murdered somebody, I don't want to know about that. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. You know, maybe just go with something like that kind of, and I love this phrase from, Gordon Lish, who I don't like, but anyway, I mean, Amy Hempel's first story was based on this prompt from Gordon Lish. That was write about what disassembles your sense of self. And I do like that kind of idea, like the thing that makes you feel like you're on unsteady ground, as a self. That may mean that like when you're trying to figure that out, you are investing the self in that. And I'm not a big like, I've become kind of not so enthusiastic about like the trauma writing, not trauma writing in general, but like writing out of your trauma, or like always trying to kind of like rush after your trauma, like re-traumatize yourself on the page. I do think there's a way in which a lot of fiction comes out of the kind of question of like what you're trying to do and who you are and how that translates in those vulnerable moments onto the page. So this is all a way of saying, I guess, like, I think you do have to have some kind of investment in whatever you're doing. Like, the problem with me, and I thought for a long time, you know, they had to separate the New York Times bestseller list into romance fiction and fiction, because it was all romance fiction, right? Like every month it was all romance fiction. Every week it was all romance fiction. And that's why we have a separate list. I was like, I'll just write, you know, I'll like read for a year a bunch of romance novels and then just like write one. But the problem is like, I can't be invested in that in the same way. You know, even with this book, my desire to write a best-selling mystery novel turned into like a super niche literary book about Asian American disappearance, right? Like that's just like, if I get invested in something, my investments are so like, I've invested in very few things, I think. I only actually can talk and care about like four things. It's like my kids, books, you know, books and writing, and like Asian American issues, you know, possibly politics. So I think I usually fuck that conversation up anyway. And so it ends up always being about the things that I care about the most. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually is maybe the best way to write. It's like the opposite of the kill your darlings thing. It's right. Like, kill all the stuff that's not your darlings. Like, why even write about that shit? Like, embrace your darling and do something with it.
Yeah, I relate totally to what you're saying. I've had like somewhat self-critical conversations. Like, first of all, I've had the same thought about a romance novel. I'm like, maybe I should just have a pseudonym and just, it's about a weatherman who falls in love with the anchor woman or whatever the fuck, you know? And then, you know, the thought of actually sitting down to do that, it's just, I can't do it. And I think the self-critical part of me is like, or maybe not self-critical, but like fatalistic, is like, maybe I am just weird and my sensibility is just not for popular consumption. You know, I don't think it's without value, but I just think that it appeals to a very small subset, or would appeal to a very small subset of the population, which again, in and of itself isn't that bad, but when it comes to making a living or making a go of it as a writer who supports himself with writing, you know, the odds get longer in that sense, you know, versus being somebody who can write like really you know, who could just churn out great horror fiction or sci-fi. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The last time I was on this show, it was like, I guess that was 2015. I was writing a bunch of essays for promoting the book, and they were all kind of directed at like a mainstream audience, by which it's obviously like a kind of white, middle-class, suburban, reads a lot of books audience, you know, like liberal-minded thing. And what I realized kind of writing all of them, at the time, I really thought they could actually do something to help, you know, like help change things. I was on like the race beat, right? Like some terrible thing would happen in the news. You know, police would murder another black man, and I would write something about it. And a lot of other people would write something about it, and people would share those things, and you know, in some ways it was like those pieces were super popular, but then like 2 days later, another terrible thing would happen. Almost the same terrible thing would happen, and we'd write about that. And then like a week later, the same thing, you know, like it would just keep going and nothing ever changed. And I started to really kind of ask myself why I was doing this then, like if it wasn't going to make a difference, like is this really what I want to do? Like just, you know, I kind of saw that what I was doing was like kind of trying to explain my experience to my white adoptive parents and just like people like them, right? Trying to make that like a real felt experience for them. And I just had to give up on that. I mean, I think it wasn't the thing I really wanted to do. And a lot of the investment comes down to audience, right? Like I'm not that invested actually in writing to the romance audience. It's not even like me. I'm invested in romance, you know, like I actually love like romantic comedies and stuff, but that's not what I want to do with myself and like my creative energies. And like, that's not who I want to talk to. And so it took me a long time just to try to kind of shift who I was writing for, to a much more specific, but also like much smaller audience of like Asian American adoptees around my age and like super liberal and who also like read a lot of literary fiction, which is, I don't know, sometimes I think it's probably like 500 to 1,000 people. But that actually mattered to me a lot more, to like, even if I could reach 500 to 1,000 people and to like do something for their lives, that was what I wanted to do. And that's where my investment was. And so I do think a lot of it comes down to audience and this like idea in workshops that like the investment should be in an investment in like a broad audience, as broad an audience as possible, right? Which means like as white an audience as possible, right? As like straight as audience as possible, like as able an audience as possible. And those things can be like really great, you know, and really great for your career. It's not something that I can really kind of invest in anymore. I just don't feel that like interested in it. And I know that if like I tried to do it, I would just have like a kind of disinterested, like, what is it called? I had a word in mind, but just like a kind of like fake offering. Right?
Well, just, yeah, that, I don't think I could sustain the energy required to finish a book even. Like, it takes so much energy for me. Like, it's not something that comes easily to me to write a book. I don't know if it comes, you know,
no.
It doesn't. I think it's, there are degrees, you know, some people have maybe an easier time of it than others. But for me, it's like, I got to be all in. And I don't, if I just did it for purely mechanical commercial reasons, A, I think I would be pretty miserable. And B, I can't imagine that the outcome would be that good. Like, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like I would just write a shitty book, you know, like.
Yeah, you'd have to really do like you'd have to like live in that world, I think. You'd have to like do the research of actually like reading and liking those books and reading them like primarily and thinking of them the same way we think of like the books, the weird books that we read, mm-hmm. right? You can't just kind of like buy in on a surface level. I also think, I was going to say something, but now I have nothing to say.
I want to I want to ask you before I let you go. I know you got to get back to your kids are downstairs, like lighting the living room on fire or something.
No, they're very happy to like be on their iPads for a limited amount.
God
of time.
God knows what they're watching on YouTube right now. They're watching how to, like, who knows? But I want to ask a broad question about how you're doing. We've gotten bits and pieces of it, and obviously you've been able to be productive in the wake of so much personal difficulty, like the loss of your wife, primarily. You know, you've been under a lot of stress, and you've had to deal with stuff that you shouldn't have to deal with at your age. And I think, you know, it's the stuff of life. And there are a lot of people listening who know you and know your work and might have listened to our first conversation on this show and who were aware of, the circumstances around your wife's health a few years ago, who have been thinking of you, like I certainly have been. And so I guess it's a two-part question. Like, first of all, like, you seem good, you know, all things considered. I know you probably have many moments that are very difficult, but you've managed to be productive. You're raising your kids. Can you talk about how you're doing and then how you've managed to keep going in the face of difficulty? Because I think people listening who might be writers or aspiring writers might have difficult circumstances of their own that feel oppressive or suffocating or are causing them to feel blocked or something like that. And I think there's maybe a lesson in what you've been able to do despite all that you've had to deal with away from the keyboard.
Yeah, sure. I mean, writers who are suffering, never heard of it. it's been really hard, actually. I mean, the world goes on, and like, you don't actually have a choice. You know, sometimes if I stop and think, I've been asked this question a lot, just like, how are you doing it? Right? Like, how are you doing it as like a, you know, I'm like a single dad, trying to teach and write and do all this stuff at the same time. And now without power and whatever, not to like make it a pity party, but I actually don't know. I have no idea how I do anything. It's just that like things have to actually be done, right? Like the kids have to eat, you know, they like have to get love. I have deadlines, like my students need to be taught. And so like the things that have to be done, get done. And I think in some ways I know for a fact, like if I didn't have kids, I would have already ruined my life by now. I would have done it like very immediately and really hard. But the circumstances of like having to do things that are actually do really matter to you have helped me a lot, that I have had to do these things, but they're also the things that I care about. I've kind of put myself in the position, luckily, where, like I said, I only care about a few things, but those are the things that my life is already kind of on track with, as a teacher of writing and writer and parent. And so the things that I have to do are also the things that make me feel alive. And there are many, many moments where, I mean, just to like put it on the table, I mean, there are many moments when I wish I was dead or, you know, like was just feel like very unalive. I mean, I actually ask myself all the time, like, am I alive? Like, am I alive right now? Is this like a life? When my wife was dying, she would ask that question, like, this, she would say, this isn't living. And I was like, well, but like, this is like the last like living that we can cling to here. But it didn't feel like living to her. And it felt so, I mean, there were some things that she said at the end that were just like so profound and like deeply painful, but also like so amazing and honest and like just like cutting through all of the bullshit of life, that I think about all the time now.
And you know, Matt, I don't, obviously you're welcome to say I don't want to share, but I'm curious to know, because you know, you set it up like so beautifully, like she said these really profound things. Is there an example of something she said that you could share?
Sure. I mean, the living thing, that was one of them. For me, one of the most painful ones was especially like right at the end, I was saying to her, like, I'm just trying to make some sense of it, that we had had a good life, or like that at least like the life that we had had together was like happy and moving and productive and emotionally fulfilling. But what she said was she hadn't had a good life. And I actually think she 100% meant that. And I don't know actually whether it's just she meant that because she hadn't had a full life, or because she was just like much less happy than I thought she was. And I think either could have been the case. Or like the things that were making me happy actually were not like the things that were making her happy, or not like totally. And I think about that all the time now, just like when we think we're like, things are going well, it's not necessarily the perspective of another person. Even a person you're so close to and spend all of your time with and love deeply. Right. The other is mysterious and unknowable and, needs to be honored as mysterious and unknowable, rather than a perspective that is tried to be occupied, rather than us trying to occupy that perspective. So those are a couple things. She said a bunch of things that kind of made me readjust how I was thinking of the years leading up to that, and the meaning that I was taking from this period of her dying versus the meaning that she was taking from it. Like, at one time she said, because I got really depressed. I mean, you know, obviously, I got really depressed. And she said, like, I'm trying so hard to live, and you're out there saying that you want to die. Right? Like, and I was, like, it was so obvious, but also, like, I don't know what the fuck I was doing with my life. I mean, I still don't know, really, so, like, you know, no success there. But there were just these moments of, like, complete clarity for her that also helped me to see the world better and clearer, even if it was more painful to me. And those moments are just like constantly active for me. I wrote this essay about grief and time and how grief sometimes feels like it's just like carrying another time with you constantly. Like, I feel like as if I'm living in the time in which we're both alive, and also like in the time in which only I am alive. And it's a feeling actually that I've had my entire life, right? Just from being adopted to like feeling as if instead of feeling as if it's like one time has stopped and another time has started, it feels constantly to me as if those times are still all active and there, and they're just like a step away, right? Like, if I could walk through my wall into the life in which I wasn't adopted, like, it's just so close. All I have to do is just step through this kind of, you know, wall of jello, to use the thing from my novel. And so I feel as if I'm living in all these different times at once, and sometimes they're more active and sometimes they're less active. And so those moments are always with me. I mean, in the time with my wife, and I have these dreams all the time, she's not actually like cured, we don't live like the life that we lived before cancer. We live like in a continuous state of cancer, of dying, right? But she's still alive. Like there's still the hope that she can beat it, or just the hope that it will just keep going on and on. For a long time, as she was doing chemo, and we kind of were reckoning with the fact that it was too late to like go through kind of any surgery or like anything that could really cure her. We felt we had the hope at least that it could just continue, you know, like continue until for her, she wanted to see the kids marry. I mean, just like that the chemo could kind of keep pushing it off or that, you know, if you waited long enough, if she survived long enough, like new forms of chemo would come up and extend what was like suffering, but was also life long enough for her to see certain things happen in the world. And I live in that kind of time now, even as I live as other time where, you know, like she's a memory to me and like an actively disappearing memory for my daughter and something that my son, who's three, doesn't even remember at all. And those seem simultaneous to me. Like they don't seem so different. And when I think like, am I okay? You know, like am I living in this world? It's hard to say. I mean, because I don't know that okay would be like to be living only in this timeline. If I think like maybe the right way to grieve, to like get over something, I don't think that I would feel as alive that way as I do living in the multiple timelines and still desiring, even if the desire is something that can't be fulfilled. You know, I sometimes right after she died, I felt like there's nothing to want anymore. You know, I actually like, I was on Amazon every day buying something on 2-day shipping just to try to like activate some kind of desire. Because when you don't feel desire, you don't feel alive. And now I just try to keep the desire for my life alive, even though like the reality that I'm living in is one in which she cannot accept or give back that love. But it seems much more alive to me than the alternative. Also seems like much more a life of kind of making, an imaginative life, like a life that kind of bleeds into art and thought and like change and just trying to make something out of life.
Can I ask you about spiritual stuff? I imagine going through what you've been through, I mean, for lack of a better word, it's going to activate some thinking and behavior around the big existential questions. And I'm just wondering, in terms of navigating the grief, taking on the responsibilities of single parenthood, all that you've been through and have to deal with, like, do you find yourself reorienting it all around spiritual attitudes or beliefs? Have you found any strength in anything along those lines at all?
We did a lot of reorienting around that while she was dying. My wife became very strongly religious during that time, and Christians, I'm Catholic, and she's basically non-denominational, but And she just became like a very firm believer in God and like an afterlife, right? And that was a way of her, a way for her to kind of keep hope alive and to like be able to kind of accommodate death in the last of her living. And I, you know, obviously I encouraged that. I didn't kind of like, I wasn't trying to poke any holes in that. I was just trying to kind of go where she needed to go. While at the same time I was reading and a lot of books about consciousness and thinking about fate and free will and these things that are in the novel a lot. How my life at that time and still like all the time really feels like very not within the realm of agency. I think actually like I've come to a place where I don't actually believe in free will at all. And that's fine. I think actually it's, for me, it's better. And, I forgot what I was saying. Spirituality. So I was dealing with this kind of thing where like, if I've come to this kind of like scientific fact that there's not like a separation between mind and body and that, consciousness comes, right? Like is a kind of, neural reaction to the things that the ways that the body lives in the world. I also had to deal with this, like the fact that I was facing, my wife dying and what happens to her consciousness, that if it's kind of like a, not like a byproduct, but like a thing of the body. I could see at that time in this really horrifying and amazing way that consciousness itself or like life or like some kind of energy was leaving her. You could like see it in her. Not only because she was like losing a lot of weight, but because she became like more, it was like the life was decreasing. You could almost see the life decreasing, right? Like she had the energy of life and then she had less of that energy. Even when she was just kind of talking or eating and like acting as normal as she could, there was a level of energy in her like aura. I don't know what to say, like her looks, her like way of being in the world that was decreasing. And at the end, it's not anything kind of new or original, but there was this kind of the profound moment of death where like it's just so, the body is so different. Like it doesn't seem like that should change everything so completely, but it was a totally different thing. Like an alive body and a dead body. That change is so complete. And I really felt like, what the hell, where did that go? You know? How could that be just like a byproduct or the product of this thing that's now like still and cold and just like feels and looks and everything is like completely different. Just in like, you know, in an instant. And trying to match that up to what I had read and thought about consciousness is still it's a mystery to me. I just don't, you know, I don't know what to think about it. I don't go to church now. I didn't really go to church that often before either, but I don't think it's any kind of like loss of religion per se. It's more like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like I'd rather like be with my kids at home. But I have noticed like my daughter has become like more cynical about religion. And I don't know if she's modeling my reactions, but my parents are super Catholic. My dad was going to become a priest when he married my mom, and they're still extremely Catholic, and they talk about God all the time, right? Like, so they'll relate everything to God and prayer. If something's going wrong, they'll say like, "We'll pray about it," as if it like will be fine. Then, and my daughter will be like, "Oh, pray about it," in a way that is just like it's both very realistic, but also like heartbreaking on the level of like me relating that back to her mom dying and not completely understanding how that has affected her spirituality. But I think of course it's gonna alter how you feel about like what's out there after death and even like what's out there in life that can't be explained by life or death. I think that's a big thing for me, just thinking of, I mean, I believe in ghosts, I guess. I believe in like these things that can't kind of be explained, but seem like clearly part of some kind of at least like a collective unconscious or something. I don't know. I don't know what to believe, but all I can give is like a really unsatisfying answer.
Well, but I think it what you're saying, what I'm hearing is you're saying that you're open to the mystery. I feel somewhat similarly. It's hard to be defined on these things in a way, especially maybe for somebody of a writerly temperament. Like, I don't think it's possible for me to come down in some really defined way about how I feel about the afterlife, just as an example, because we're not dealing with anything evidentiary. You're dealing with maybe a little bit like you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, people who have died and then come back to life and like who were conscious enough in the process to report, some sort of experiential record. But, it's murky. And at the same time, I think on a practical level, when you're dealing with deep grief or trying to shoulder the burdens of fatherhood, as a widower, and I think of my own experience, like trying to be the parent of a disabled child and just anything in life that's heavy and difficult, it's hard not to try to figure out some sort of way of relating to life and the world that doesn't have at least some element of magic or mysticism in it, like an openness to there being levels of consciousness, for example, that we simply don't have awareness of in our day-to-day reality, but that are there nonetheless. The belief that there might be a spirit realm. Like, who fucking knows? Like, I mean, I can't prove it, but there definitely is a lot of anecdotal evidence that people have experiences they can't explain. Are all of them full of shit? I mean, is everybody lying? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm open. Like, I'm a skeptic, but I'm open. And I think maybe the word that I land on at the end of it all is just humility. Like, we really don't know very much, in the grand scheme of things, about what this is or where we even are. And, I think having some degree of wonder in your fundamental worldview and approach to life is proportionate, right? I don't know.
Wonder is a great word for, I mean, I think I spent like a year just like rereading the books that I loved as a child. Because I mean, this is going to sound off track, but it's totally trying to answer this. When I was a kid, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I think it's pretty common that like I hardly felt as if I was reading a book. Like if it really felt as if I was living within it and like I could see the book. Like I could literally see it. the images in the book. My parents used to like get really upset that I wasn't answering their like demands while I was reading a book, and I like literally had not heard it. You know, I had not heard anything. And that experience of reading has kind of gone away from me now, and I don't like see it visually as much, and I don't kind of have that total immersion in it. And I wanted to see like whether or not I could, whether it was like the books or me. And so I read for a year just like all of these middle grade YA books that I loved as kids and as a kid, and I actually was really able to recapture a lot of it. And I really wanted to know like what that was, and like what's going away in the transition from those books to the books that I read and love as an adult, you know, that are like adult fiction or whatever. And I think a lot of it is wonder. I think like there's so much more wonder in those kids' books than there is in adult, even like really amazing adult books. Like so much of the kids' literature is the wonder is externalized, right? I think that's part of it too, that there's still wonder in some ways in adult literary fiction, but like for the kids' books, so much of that wonder is in the world, right? And it, you know, maybe just because like the experience of being a kid, right? It's just like you have so much wonder, and the world seems so mysterious, and it is mysterious, but maybe we like sacrificed that mystery in some way to self-awareness. I'm actually writing a book right now, or working on a book called The Sense of Wonder that came out of trying to like, I was like, I want to write a book with some wonder in it, for adults. And the time I could think of that where I felt the most wonder as an adult in real life was when Jeremy Lin was going off. And in K-dramas. So like the book is about like Jeremy Lin and K-dramas. But
Jeremy Lin being the NBA, the Asian NBA basketball star.
Yes, yeah. I had this conversation with somebody a little while ago where we were saying like that's the best I've ever felt about America was during Linsanity, during that like week and a half of Jeremy Lin winning games and going like mad on that court. That was the best I've ever felt about America. It just seems like so much more was possible than was possible right before that. And that's kind of wonder, right? And I get that same feeling sometimes from K-dramas, and so I kind of just, you know, it was also really just an excuse to write about things that I like to write about, as we go back to our earlier conversation, right? Just the things that I like, basketball and K-drama.
What is K, for people listening who might not know, what is K-drama?
So K-drama are Korean dramas, which are basically like mini-series. Like if you think of like those HBO mini-series, so they're like often 16 or 20 episode long shows that have a beginning, middle, and end. It's all kind of planned out. I actually think they're super, maybe the most close visual form to a novel. The episodes are all like an hour long, and they go somewhere. Like instead of the kind of the way that you have to leave so many things open because you don't know when the show will end. In American TV, that's all part of in K-dramas, it's all directed, right? And so like, just like a novel, they know where they're going, and the show, everything in the show means something to the larger kind of project, and has a kind of central through line and follows like a very similar structure to the novel, or at least a kind of like a traditional novel, traditional in like a Western psychological realism sense. I don't know. I was just explaining what a K-drama is, right?
Well,
love them so much.
They're amazing. Do you watch them?
Netflix mainly now. Netflix is now like basically bought a cable. I don't know what they did, but they, all of the K-dramas on a certain cable network in Korea are now on Netflix, and Netflix finances these dramas. And so they're like really amazingly produced, and you know, they hire really great actors and writers and stuff. But I also watch the ones on different, you know, different channels on a program called Viki, which is crowdsourced subtitles from people all over the world. So you can, like, you know, get subtitles in all these different languages that people have just done themselves, which is, it feels like nice in a way. But sometimes the translations are not as good as, say, on Netflix. But I spend a lot of time, I basically only watch K-drama now on TV, because it feels like, because of that sense of wonder, and because it feels like I'm also doing something that's helpful for my writing, for writing novels. So I kind of have made myself like an exclusive K-drama TV watcher now.
I get that. You got to pick and choose, right? You only have so much Netflix time. You might as well be something like what better way to assuage the guilt of sitting around watching Netflix as a, you know, we're supposed to be ultra productive, right? At all times. And now you can feel like you're being productive while you watch Netflix.
It's true. You have to kind of like, it's ideal to design a project around research and something that's not really research, right? Like, if I'm writing a novel about K-drama, then I can just watch K-dramas as research, right? Like, there's a nice way in which you can set yourself the parameters that allow you to do what is not actually productive in a productive way. It's the best. I mean, I think we can do more to, like, help our mental health sometimes.
Mm. Well, I, you know, I just want to say you and your family have been in my thoughts, you know, over the past couple of years, 2-3 years. And I know I'm far from alone. There are a lot of people in the literary community, including lots of people you don't even know and have never met before, who have been thinking about you and wishing you well. And I'm really excited for you with this new book. I'm excited about the one about wonder. I feel kind of proud of myself for even bringing up that term, considering that's like, it feels sort of like kismet, right? But I don't know. I'm just pulling for you. And I'm sort of in awe of your resilience and your ability to keep going and to keep doing good work, despite all that you've had to cope with. And I just want you to know that, you know, I'm wishing you well on behalf of a lot of us.
Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who's listening and who has in any way thought about my family and or contributed to our survival, which is a lot of people. You're right. I think it's really been amazing to me to see people out there make these connections through the written word, right?
Well, Matt, I appreciate the time. I'll let you go find out what your kids are up to. And I just wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, Brad. This has been great. I wish we could have this conversation each week.
All right, that's Matthew Salicis. His new novel is called Disappear, Doppelganger, Disappear, available now from Little A Publishing. You can track him down on the internet at MatthewSalicis.com, and you can follow him on Twitter. His handle is @Salicis. The novel, once again, is called Disappear, Doppelganger, Disappear, available now from Little A Publishing. Go get your copy immediately. Buy two of them and give one away. What do you think of that? The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show, 670 episodes and counting, all of it is offered to you freely. It's a listener-supported show. If you like the show and you listen regularly and you have the means, throw a couple of bucks in the hat over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you want to write to me, if you have something to say, the email address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to participate in our fun little interactive game, the hashtag Where I Listen, where, you know, listeners send in photos of where they listen, you could send a selfie and a picture of where you are when you listen, or you could just send a photo of where, you know, the setting that you're in. We want to see where you listen. Where are you right now in space? Where are you right now? Where do you listen? You can DM a photo at the show's social media feeds on Twitter @OtherPPL or on Instagram at otherppl.podcast. You can also email me your pick or picks. The email address is letters@otherppl.com. It's fun. Go to the show's Instagram feed and check out all the Where I Listen photos. It's interesting to see where people are, you know? Don't forget about the Other People app. This program has its own official app. It's free. Everything's free. Go get the app wherever you get apps. It's a good app. I'm falling behind. I don't know who's up next. I wish I could tell you. It's going to have to be a mystery. This heat wave, these fires, this live blog that I'm doing. Oh, yeah, don't forget about that. Bradpocalypse.blogspot.com.